much appreciate being here, if it's only for a few days. Okay, so what I want to talk about is some work that we've been doing concerning non-Fermi liquid behavior in yttrium and thorium-substituted uranium plating 2, aluminum 3. And I wanted to acknowledge my co-workers at San Diego, Andrea Saman, Robert Dickey, Eric Freeman, Carlos Chauvent, Marcio de Andrade, and Neil Dilley. And I'll also talk about some previous work involving Yassine Dalashaouche and Jan Herman, who moved on to other institutions, and also a longtime collaborator at Los Alamos, Roman Mashevich. During the past decade, which is kind of hard for me to believe, there's been a growing interest in non-Fermi liquid behavior in F electron materials, which is what I want to talk about today, as I said. And the materials are mostly uranium and cerium intermetallic compounds, although recently some examples have been found involving ytterbium. And in these materials, the uranium, cerium, or ytterbium carry magnetic dipole or electric quadrupole moments. And this behavior was first identified or established in chemically substituted materials, such as the ones I've indicated here. But during the last two or three years, it's also been identified in a number of stoichiometric compounds, such as these compounds at zero pressure and these two compounds at high pressures, which I'll return to at the end of the talk. And the physical properties of these materials at temperatures much lower than some characteristic temperature involve weak power law or logarithmic divergences in temperature, and this is to be contrasted with the usual Fermi liquid behavior, where the specific heat divided by temperature, or gamma as it's called, and the susceptibility approach constant values, and the resistivity varies as the temperature squared at temperatures much lower than the effective Fermi temperature. That would play the role of T0 in these kinds of materials. The experiments that have been performed, you know, during the last decade suggest that there are several routes to non-Fermi liquid behavior. One, I believe, involves an unconventional Kondo effect, where the physical properties at low temperatures exhibit these non-Fermi liquid characteristics that I'll talk about, and they scale with concentration of paramagnetic ions and the Kondo temperature, suggesting that one's dealing here with a single ion effect. And there have been a number of models proposed, such as a multi-channel Kondo effect of either magnetic or electric, or equivalently quadrupolar origin. I'll say more about this. And Dan Cox, and I'm sorry he's not here today, but he was one of the inventors of one of these models. And also another approach is the Kondo effect with a disorder-driven distribution of Kondo temperatures, the so-called Kondo disorder model. And that really is a superposition of ordinary Kondo effects where, with different TKs, and that situation can kind of mimic a non-Fermi liquid a situation. With that model. No, it is single ion, but due to the distribution of ligands around a particular ion, you get different exchange interactions, which gives you different Kondo temperatures. And then when you superpose all those together, you get something that doesn't look like an ordinary Kondo effect, but has characteristics that are similar to these non-Fermi liquid characteristics. That, to me, is not a true non-Fermi liquid. But, you know, it's an interesting model, and it certainly does appear to be relevant to some systems. Okay, the other approach is one in which you have a second-order phase transition at zero Kelvin, which can be usually as magnetic, but it could be quadrupolar in nature. And there, the physical properties at low temperature exhibit non-Fermi liquid characteristics near some critical concentration or pressure, where the temperature characterizing the phase transition vanishes, so that one has a quantum critical point. And here is one is dealing with a cooperative phenomenon. And there have been a number of people who have worked on models based upon fluctuations of an order parameter in the vicinity of a second order phase transition at zero Kelvin. And I'll say more about that. And then also Castroneto, Castilla, and Jones have proposed within the last few years a Griffiths phase model where they suggest that there are magnetic clusters in a non-magnetic background, and all this comes about because of the competition between the Kondo and RKKY interactions in the presence of anisotropy and disorder. And I'll say a little bit more about that, but not too much. Okay, so the experiments that I'm going to talk about, which I will talk about after I make a little excursion into some of the history, is this parent compound, uranium, platinum, 2, aluminum, 3. This is a moderately heavy electron antiferromagnetic superconductor. It has a gamma electronic specific heat coefficient of about 140 millijoules per mole Kelvin squared, a Nail temperature of 14.6 Kelvin with a relatively large ordered magnetic moment for these types of materials of 0.85 Bohr magnetons and a superconducting critical temperature of 2 Kelvin, so that below TC you get the coexistence of superconductivity and antiferromagnetism, which is quite an interesting phenomenon in its own right. Maybe I'll say more about that. It has a hexagonal praseodymium nickel 2 aluminum 3 structure, and the experiments I want to talk about are ones in which you substitute tetravalent thorium and trivalent yttrium separately for uranium in uranium platinum 2 aluminum 3, and what we found is that you get dramatically different temperature composition phase diagrams with different non-Fermi liquid regimes, non-Fermi liquid temperature dependences, and also presumably different underlying mechanisms. The ones that one usually tries are non-magnetic ones, scandium, yttrium, and lanthanum would be, or lutetium. Yttrium works, thorium works, lanthanum we're working on now. It gives even another different type of behavior, which I'll perhaps mention at the end. And scandium doesn't seem to work. And so, you know, you try what you can. And yes. Well, for reasons that I'll describe, I think it's probably 4 plus. Yeah.
But in principle, it's clearly known what's responsible for the behavior of uranium. Because the theorem is more or less clear what kind of configuration participates in uranium. Well,
it's not so clear. Yeah, it's not so clear. Well, it's very difficult to identify the valence of uranium, and only in a few examples is it clear-cut. And it's not really clear-cut in this system, although there's evidence that it's tetravalent.
And
so
then the origin of tetravalent material in most of the
I don't think it's clear. Okay, one approach is a Kondo lattice model, which hasn't been solved, to my knowledge. I think you were discussing this earlier. Yes, but I'll show you an example where you'd actually have a very nice Kondo effect in a uranium impurity system. And so if I kind of generalize that, one might presume that in some uranium systems that might be a good approach. But I don't know the answer to that. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about are measurements of the electrical resistivity, specific heat, and magnetization as a function of composition, temperature, and magnetic field, down to low temperatures, as low as 20 millikelvin, some cases. And we've worked mainly on polycrystalline materials because this is very exploratory, and single crystal work is in progress. Okay, so let me now make some introductory remarks and some historical remarks for those of you who are substantially younger than me. And there are a few of you in here, and although you may still know this. basically, this is the periodic table, and we'll be mainly concerned with uranium, which sits right here. And if you have tetravalent uranium, which is the situation that I want to talk about here, then you have 2 f electrons. You have spin 1, angular momentum equal to 5, orbital angular momentum, and j equals 4, the total angular momentum. And here's cerium, the other element that gives rise to this behavior sitting right here. So it has 1 f electron. And also, as I mentioned, the terbium is the f-hole analog of cerium, and these types of features have also been observed for this ion, but I won't be talking about that. Okay, so let me make a few remarks about the Kondo effect itself, very general remarks. The Kondo effect comes about when you have a non-magnetic host metal containing small concentrations of paramagnetic impurities that carry some spin S, and these paramagnetic impurities have partially filled D or F electron shells, and historically this was first studied in 3D transition metals where one had ions like chromium, vanadium, manganese, iron, and nickel, which were the ions with partially filled D shells, and a very famous Kondo system is the copper iron system, for example. Later on, Kondo effect was observed in 4F rare earth systems, and the ions involved there are cerium, praseodymium, and ytterbium, and a very well-known Kondo system that we actually discovered back in the late 60s, early 70s was lanthanum aluminum 2 doped with cerium. And then another one, which I'll say more about, is for the 5F actinide uranium, and the thorium uranium system is a very good Kondo system. And presumably the other actinides would give rise to this behavior here also, but they're very difficult to study for obvious reasons. But we can study thorium and uranium with no difficulty. The conduction electrons carry, say, spin sigma of the host metal. These are scattered by magnetic impurity ions with spin S via the exchange interaction, indicated right here, where the exchange interaction parameter has this approximate form, where VKF is a matrix element admixing the localized D or F states and the conduction electron states, and then E sub F here is the binding energy, or the energy separating the centroid of the F level and the Fermi level. The thermodynamic energy scale, as you probably know, is the Kondo temperature, which is proportional to the Fermi temperature, and an exponential involving the density of states at the Fermi level and the magnitude of this exchange interaction parameter. And the physical picture that has emerged is that a many-body singlet forms as the temperature is lowered through the Kondo temperature, so that at zero temperature you have antiferromagnetic screening of the impurity moment by the or impurity spin by the spins of the conduction electron. You also obtain a temperature-dependent Kondo or Abrikosov-Sewell resonance, so that the density states as a function of energy looks something as I've schematically indicated here, where you have an F state broadened by interactions with the conduction electrons that holds N electrons, and then split off by the Coulomb energy, a state that would hold N plus 1 electrons. And then at the Fermi level, you find this Kondo or Abrikosov-Sewell resonance with the width of the order of TK that then determines the thermodynamic properties of the system. And at high temperatures, you see a local moment type behavior where the susceptibility can be described by a Curie-Weiss law neglecting crystal field effects. And the Curie-Weiss temperature here is usually negative and of the order of 3 or 4 times the Kondo temperature. The effective moment is close to the free ion value, but usually somewhat reduced. And then the most, spectacular or historically interesting phenomenon is this minus log T divergence of the electrical resistivity, so that when you put this together with the phonon contribution, you get this famous minimum in electrical resistivity that was first explained by Kondo in 1964 in his famous paper. Okay, but what we're interested in is what happens at low temperatures, at temperatures much lower than TK. There you get the formation of this mini body singlet ground state, and this behaves as a local Fermi liquid where the effective Fermi temperature is TK, and what one finds is that the susceptibility and the electronic specific heat coefficient approach constant values. They're proportional to the density of states at the Fermi level, which is in turn proportional to 1 over TK, and then you get this characteristic T squared behavior in the resistivity that scales with TK. Okay, and then coming back to heavy fermion compounds, many people believe that the underlying physics there is the Kondo effect, so presumably one would then be dealing with the Kondo lattice, which is another story altogether. Okay, so let me show you a system that we studied back in 1970. This is the thorium-uranium system. And this really behaves as a very conventional condo system. So what one finds is that if you measure the specific heat, it's proportional to temperature at temperatures much lower than TK, and you get a specific heat of about 270 millijoules per mole uranium K squared that's associated with the uranium substitutions. So if you were to have a whole lattice of these uranium ions, then this would be a moderately heavy fermion material with a gamma of 270 millijoules per mole uranium K squared. The resistivity is shown here. Here's rho versus T, and this is pure thorium. You just see the phonon contribution to the resistivity and an impurity contribution here. And then as you substitute in uranium, you see the development of this resistivity minimum. If you now subtract off the background from the thorium, you get the resistivity that's associated with scattering from the uranium ions, and this is plotted versus temperature squared. And so you can see it's described by this expression right here. And then from the slope, you can infer the condo temperature, which turns out to be about 100 Kelvin for this system. So this behaves like a local Fermi liquid. And just to show you some other properties, here's the magnetic susceptibility versus temperature. Here at higher temperatures above TK, which is about here, you can fit this with the Curie-Weiss law. And this fit gives you an effective moment of 3.43 Bohr magnetons. And for either trivalent or tetravalent uranium, the free ion moment is about 3.6 Bohr magnetons. The Curie-Weiss temperature is negative and about 3 times TK, which is, again, fits in with the general phenomenology for condo systems. And then also, if you look at the thermoelectric power, you find a peak around 80 Kelvin, which is close to TK, and then condo systems, you often find a peak in the thermal power near TK.
What's the Wilson ratio?
I'm sorry?
What's the Wilson ratio for this one?
It's close to one. Yeah.
So
yeah,
the
sure.
Right here,
yes.
The one before that, you talked about the log.
Right. Well, here, TK is 100 degrees, so that to see the log T part, you'd have to go to much higher temperatures. So I just showed you one with a very low T, a very relatively high TK. Yeah.
How small was the building to see the
conventional? Oh, yeah. Well, for rare earth and actinide ions, it can be at the percent level. And for transition metal ions, where the interactions are much stronger, then you'll already be seeing spin glass behavior at those concentrations. So there, you generally have to work in the parts per million range. And for example, in copper manganese, even at 10 ppm in the millikelvin range, you have spin glass ordering. So, but in rare earths, and in particular, you can work at rather large concentrations. Okay, so that's kind of some background for the conventional condo effect. Now I want to turn to some other more exotic condo effects. And one is the so-called multi-channel condo effect, which was first considered by Nozier and Blondin in 1980. And again, one's working with the same exchange Hamiltonian, where the impurity spin S can be greater than or equal to 1/2. Now one has M conduction band channels with a spin sigma sub I that screen out the impurity spin with an effective spin of M over 2. M's the number of channels. And then the total spin at T equals 0 is going to be S minus M over 2. Now, this leads to three different cases. One is that if M is equal to 2S, you get perfect screening at zero temperature. And so then one should get a many-body singlet ground state that behaves like a local Fermi liquid in much the same way that I've just discussed. If M is smaller than 2S, then you get partial screening. Then you're left with a decoupled residual impurity spin of S minus M over 2. And according to this work, one should get a Fermi liquid with Curie law behavior and the susceptibility. And then the third case, which is the most interesting one from our perspective, is where M is greater than 2S, where you get overscreening of the impurity spin. And then you should get a local non-Fermi liquid and with critical behavior at zero temperature. And the case that I want to focus on is the one where M is equal to 2 and S is equal to 1/2. This is called the two-channel spin one-half Kondo model. Okay, and the predictions of this model are indicated at the bottom of the view graph. I've already discussed what happens in the single-channel case. So at temperatures much lower than TK for the two-channel case for spin one-half, then again you get overscreening. It behaves like a local non-Fermi liquid. The magnetic susceptibility and the electronic specific heat coefficient are predicted to diverge logarithmically, and there's a coefficient of 1 over TK prefactor here. You're also supposed to get a residual entropy of R over 2 log 2 at zero temperature, and the resistivity, according to calculations by Ludwig and Affleck, should vary as the temperature to the 1 half. And what you notice here is that all these properties scale with TK, so that for the case of a conventional Kondo effect where you have a Fermi liquid, then everything is more or less temperature independent, or at least a first approximation below TK. Here you see that things are relatively temperature dependent at temperatures much lower than TK, and so this introduces into the system some lower energy scale, which is one of the features of these non-Fermi liquid situations.
Yeah.
You always ask these hard questions. Well, I have one system, one situation where it's easy. Let me talk about that and then come back to your question, which I don't think I can answer. But the one I can understand is the quadrupolar Kondo effect, which was first addressed by Dan Cox in 1987 when he was actually trying to explain the properties of uranium-beryllium-13, which he thought behaved as a non-Fermi liquid. Here, this is the electric analog of the usual magnetic Kondo effect, where the Hamiltonian has the form of the two-channel spin one-half Kondo Hamiltonian, but now the spin is an impurity pseudo-spin of one-half, which is associated with the electric quadrupole moment, which is associated in turn with a charge distribution that could be represented by a prolate spheroid, that would be spin up, and the other charge distribution is an oblate spheroid, that would be spin down. And then these interact with sigma 1 and sigma 2 conduction electron pseudospins. And these in turn belong to time-reversed magnetic spin up and magnetic spin down channels. So the magnetic spin now just becomes a channel index, and this is where the two channels come from. And the screening of the impurity pseudospin is done by sigma one, sigma two, these conduction electron pseudospins. Okay, so that's where the two channels come from in this case. Now, this in principle can be realized in uranium alloys. That's why we've spent so much time working on uranium, because if uranium is tetravalent, this 5F2 ninefold degenerate J equal 4 ground state multiplet splits into in the cubic crystalline electric field into a gamma 1 singlet, gamma 4, and gamma 5 triplets, and a gamma 3 non-Cramers non-magnetic doublet that has a finite electric quadrupole moment. Okay, and I've drawn the energy level scheme here just very schematically, but I've drawn it with gamma 3 as the ground state, because if gamma 3 were the ground state, then one would expect to see a quadrupolar Kondo effect. And in that case, the quadrupolar susceptibility would vary as predicted, or presumably vary as predicted, like 1 over TK times the log of T over TK, as would the specific heat. But what we generally measure is the magnetic susceptibility, and this, according to Dan Cox, ought to look like the Van Vleck susceptibility modified by hybridization with the conduction electrons, and he predicts it should vary as 1 minus T over TK to the 1 half power. Okay? So this is what we ordinarily measure. So this then would be another signature of this quadrupolar Kondo effect. Now, coming back to the question of what happens in a magnetic Kondo effect that has more than one channel, there I guess it would be the orbital indices that would distinguish between the different channels.
Can you only find out the proper amount of channels in an electrolyte system?
Well, can you have enough?
What's the local activity for the polar degree of freedom?
Yeah.
So what about conduction electrons? Is it enough in that degree of freedom to...
Well, that's another issue. I mean, there is the so-called Kondo exhaustion problem, which I'm not even thinking about, because there, you know, there's a viewpoint, well, it's more than a viewpoint. If we're going to screen out these impurity spins, then this presumably is going to involve conduction electrons near the Fermi level. And so if you go to the large concentrations that we're talking about...
No, I'm not talking about this, yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I see.
Is it always the case that they can form like a state of conduction electrons? Give you a kind of quantum that you know that
it can. Yeah. Okay, I don't think I can answer that question, I think. Anyone care to? Okay, so now I'm not really going to go into this any further, but I just wanted to mention that there are two systems that I would consider the best prospects for the quadrupolar Kondo effect, and one of them is one that we worked on since 1990 at UCSD. This is the M uranium palladium 3 system, where M can be yttrium or scandium. And here we believe, or pretty sure, that the uranium valence is plus 4. The uranium ground state in the crystalline electric field appears to be a gamma 3 with a very low lying gamma 5 ground state, so that you can nearly consider them to be degenerate, although this is not completely established yet. The resistivity actually is linear in temperature, so this does not satisfy the predictions of the quadrupolar Kondo effect, but it could, I'm hoping, that perhaps this observation might have something to do with this low-lying gamma 5. On the other hand, the specific heat divided by temperature does diverge logarithmically in temperature. There is evidence for this residual entropy of R over 2 log 2, and the susceptibility does have this predicted T to the 1/2 behavior. And also in the uranium, thorium, beryllium 13 system, there is also evidence for this quadrupolar Kondo effect, although there the uranium valence isn't really known and the uranium ground state isn't very known. But this system does have a T to the 1/2 resistivity that is consistent with predictions, although that crosses over to a linear T dependence at lower temperature. You know, after almost 10 years of work, this has not been established, but there's lots of evidence that seem to point in this direction. And I'll just show you the phase diagrams of the yttrium uranium palladium 3 system. Here is temperature versus X. So this is yttrium uranium palladium 3. And we're interested in this cubic structure that occurs in this part of the phase diagram. Here you have long-range antiferromagnetic order. You have a spin glass phase over here. The Kondo temperature exhibits large variations that are associated with the fact that when you substitute uranium, which is tetravalent, or yttrium, which is trivalent, if you move this way in the phase diagram, then you're increasing the Fermi energy, and that changes the distance of the F level from the Fermi level in such a way that you can explain this large variation in the Kondo temperature. And one finds a non-Fermi liquid behavior in this concentration range that actually scales with TK. And the same thing happens with this system, where M is scandium instead of yttrium. And just to show you what the properties look like, and these are the kind of properties I'll be talking about shortly and with respect to this other system, here's resistivity versus temperature. And this is for the scandium-based system. This is for the yttrium-based system. And this is at the higher uranium concentrations where the effects are strongest. And here you see that the resistivity is linear. Here it's nearly linear. I think the exponent's 1.1. Here you see the specific heat divided by temperature plotted versus log T. You see the logarithmic divergence of the specific heat for both systems. And here you see the magnetic susceptibility versus T to the 1/2. Both systems have this same behavior. So there's lots of evidence, you know, for this quadrupolar Kondo effect in the system. But it's not completely established. But what I would say is that the physics here seems to be single ion physics, because all of these properties scale with the condo temperature and the concentration. And I want to come back to that in a moment with respect to this other system. Okay, now let me just make a few remarks about other situations. The other situation that one encounters are where you have fluctuations of an order parameter near the second order phase transition at zero Kelvin, so that you're dealing with a quantum critical point. And there have been predictions made by Millis and Moria and Takamoto and Roche and many others of how the specific heat divided by temperature, the resistivity, and the ordering temperature associated with whatever phase transition we're dealing with should vary with the control parameter or temperature near the magnetic quantum critical point. And so the control parameter here would be either composition or pressure. The critical value would be the value where TC would vanish. And let's look at the antiferromagnetic case, because that's what we're going to discuss. Here, for the 3D antiferromagnetic case, C over T should vary as T to the 1/2 with a constant term here. The resistivity should vary as T to the 3/2, and TC of delta should vary as delta sub C minus delta to the 2/3. So this would be either composition or pressure. And then the 2D case, which will be relevant for reasons that we'll discuss later, that has a log T divergence, just like the prediction for the quadrupolar condo effect. It also has a linear temperature dependence, like is observed for the system I just discussed. And this phase boundary should come in to zero linearly in this control parameter. So I'll come back to this later on. And that's an entirely different situation. Another situation which sort of tries to incorporate the single ion physics and the cooperative physics, or the interacting ion physics, is the Griffiths phase model proposed by Castroneto, Castilla, and Jones. And there, this involves disorder and the competition between the RKKY and condo interactions. And here, what's proposed is that you get an inhomogeneous system consisting of two electronic fluids, a paramagnetic phase, which behaves as a Fermi liquid, which is associated with the ordinary condo effect, and then clusters of interacting magnetic moments that are coupled together via the RKKY interaction, so that one is dealing effectively with giant spins that tunnel over classically forbidden regions at low temperature, giving rise to low energy excitations, such that the specific heat divided by temperature and the susceptibility then are predicted to vary as the temperature to the minus 1 plus lambda power, where lambda is a parameter here that characterizes the Griffiths phase and presumably could be calculated microscopically. But when lambda is smaller than 1, then you get non-Fermi liquid like weakly temperature dependent power law behavior. And these two properties then diverge at low temperatures as this power law form. If lambda is equal to 1, then you just get a Fermi liquid. Okay, so that's, yeah, sure. It's phenomenological, yes, fudge factor, that's good. Yeah. I mean, there's no microscopic calculation here. But. I don't think so, yeah. I mean, they try to write down a Hamiltonian, and presumably, you know, if you knew enough about the system, you could calculate it, but at the level in which it's done, it's just a phenomenological parameter. Okay. Now, let me just say at this point that non-Fermi liquid behavior has been observed in many systems, and I'm not going to talk about all of these systems. I just want to show you this to emphasize that this is a general phenomenon, and this is a view graph I made back in about 1994, and I haven't updated because it fills the paper, but there are probably three times as many systems that are known now, and also some stoichiometric compounds. But virtually all of them have a specific heat divided by temperature that diverges logarithmically. That's what this yes means. And the resistivity of most of these systems is linear. The coefficient is usually positive, so that the resistivity increases as you lower the temperature. Sometimes, however, it decreases linearly as you lower the temperature. And only in one case do you get a T to the 1/2 behavior. This is the thorium, uranium, beryllium 13 system that I mentioned. And the susceptibility usually varies as T to the 1/2, although sometimes a logarithmic dependence is a better fit. Also, I should say that over the two decades that most of these properties are measured, one can also fit these properties to a weak power law that's consistent with this Griffiths phase model. Yes. It depends. On this system that I'll talk about, it's over a range. I'm going to talk about that next. In this system, it's over a range. In this system right here, this is the one that Hilbert von Lohneisen has worked on for many years, it's very sharply tuned to this concentration. And here it's most certainly due to this magnetic phase transition that's suppressed to zero at that composition, which is X equal, which is gold 0.1. You move to the left, you get Fermi liquid. You move to the right, you get antiferromagnetic order. So it really depends. And what I'm going to show you next is a system where you get both types of behavior. Okay, so let me come to that. Now, if you can remember back to what I said in the beginning, the parent compound, it was kind of a long diversion, the parent compound is uranium, platinum, 2, aluminum, 3, which is, as I said, a moderately heavy fermion antiferromagnetic superconductor. And this is the magnetic structure. These are the uranium ions. Platinum is right here. These are the aluminum atoms. And these are the magnetic moments in the basal plane. They're essentially, you have an antiferromagnetic stacking along the C-axis, which is in this direction, of ferromagnetic sheets in the basal plane, and the ordered moments about 0.85 Bohr magnetons. And this material is of great interest because there's also a lot of evidence that it's an anisotropic superconductor with an energy gap that vanishes along the equator over the Fermi surface. And you also have coexistence of antiferromagnetism and superconductivity, and there's evidence that the pairing actually comes from fluctuations, antiferromagnetic spin fluctuations. But we're interested in an entirely different aspect. So that's summarized in these two phase diagrams. Here's what happens if you substitute thorium for uranium in the system. You get this phase diagram here. So on the left, you see the nail temperature, which drops off relatively slowly, and the superconduction critical temperature that drops off slowly also. But even though these two critical temperatures don't change very much, what happens is that the features associated with the antiferromagnetism and the superconductivity diminish very rapidly as you move towards the right to increasing thorium concentrations. It then crosses over into another regime over here, where at high temperatures you get what looks like a rather ordinary Kondo effect, but at low temperatures you find it has non-Fermi liquid characteristics. And for reasons that I'll discuss, the Kondo temperature seems to be nearly concentration independent, as indicated by these points right here. Now this is to be, okay, now the other thing I should say is that the fact that these two temperatures don't change very much and the Kondo temperature doesn't change very much suggests to me that the thorium, that the uranium is probably tetravalent, because this thorium is certainly tetravalent, and so that's the main evidence for this system for tetravalency of uranium. There is no other evidence from neutron scattering or any other probe that can give you that information for that system.
And you basically believe it's what the connection is to using the Lorentz state of uranium, because the magnetic moment seems to be very close to the 4+.
Yeah, that's right. No, it's very, well, only in special cases. In uranium platinum 3, which is the parent compound of the system I discussed previously, there you can actually see very sharp crystal electric field excitations in inelastic neutron scattering. And also you can do experiments that I didn't discuss where you look at lattice parameters, and there you can really establish that it's tetravalent. But that's one of the very few cases in actinides where you can do that. Yeah, you just never know. It's Okay, now this now is to be contrasted with what happens when you substitute in yttrium. There you get the nail temperature dropping off rather rapidly and vanishing at about 0.7 here, yttrium concentration. TC drops off very rapidly, and it's in this regime right here that you get the non-Fermi liquid behavior. Now, during this past week, we've been thinking that this is the nail temperature dropping off like this. As of last week, we now think that probably in this region right here, this is a spin glass. So we're accumulating evidence that suggests that this is a spin glass. So some of the conclusions that I have tentatively drawn, well, I don't know whether they'll change or not, but I'll come to that later on. Well, it's a range of X, but it's very close to this quantum critical point here. Whereas here, it's a broad range of X.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. Yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah. And there should be a range of X over which usually what happens is that the nail temperature will drop off like this, or could be a Curie temperature, and then there'll be another line right here, and you'll get non-Fermi liquid behavior according to theory in this range right here. Although over here it'll cross over at lower temperatures to Fermi liquid behavior. These arrows mean that it's been measured down to this temperature. Okay. Now let me show you. Okay, so now I'm going to look at the thorium dope system first, and let me show you what you find there. This is specific heat divided by temperature versus the log of the temperature. Let's start at the end where we have uranium, platinum 2, aluminum 3. This is the feature associated with the antiferromagnetic order. Then at low temperatures, you see the jump associated with the superconductivity. Then as you substitute in thorium, when you reach 10%, you see no indication of the superconductivity in the specific heat, although you do see a little jump associated with the antiferromagnetism. When you reach 20%, you see a little feature associated with the antiferromagnetism, nothing that corresponds to the superconductivity. And then you see the development of this increase as you lower the temperature. And then at higher temperatures, where you're in what we refer to as this non-Fermi liquid region, then you see this linear or this logarithmic divergence of C over T, and you see that this persists all the way up to X equals 0.8. But you see that the slope here decreases, and the reason it decreases is because as you move in this direction, you're diluting the uranium system. You have less uranium ions, and so therefore this slope decreases. And then, of course, you eventually reach the behavior of pure thorium, platinum 2, aluminum 3. Now, if you take this behavior and you divide this by TK and the concentration, then what you find is that, you know, to reasonable approximation, it looks like a single ion situation. So this is C over T versus temperature. I guess we haven't divided by TK yet. So this is just dividing by uranium concentration. You see that these curves, you know, within experimental error, look more or less lie on top of each other. So this is X equal 0.4, 0.6, and 0.8. And so I would say that C over T scales with uranium concentration, and the slope here is a measure of TK if you analyze this within the context of the two-channel spin one-half Kondo model, just as a phenomenological matter. I'm not trying to say that this is what describes the system, but it turns out that you can use this result and actually use it in a phenomenological sense and compare a lot of data together. And if you do that, then you would infer a Kondo temperature, which is about 20 Kelvin for these three specific heat measurements. Okay? Yes? Well, to first approximation, I mean, I know I'm dealing with enormous concentrations here.
But my question, yeah. There was no, at least theoretically, what to expect in this substitution. Is there anything like coherence regime also which would change the properties, like for instance, an ordinary
Oh, yeah, yeah, right, right. Yes, yes, yeah. Yeah, right, right. Yes, okay. Yes. Yes, yes, you should and you will. And I'll show you that next. Okay, so I'll come to that. I probably a Fermi liquid. Yeah, that's my guess. Okay. Well, I don't want to say that because remember there are these stoichiometric compounds that do have this non-Fermi liquid like behavior, and yeah, that's right. Yeah, right. Yes. Well, let me come to that shortly, and I'll show you what happens for this system. That's a good question. At any rate, I'm just addressing the specific heat first to show you how general this logarithmic divergence is, and that for this system, you can describe this in terms of a single TK, although I am appealing to a specific model, but not trying to endorse that model, and also it scales with uranium concentration. Okay, I'll come back to that. Okay, now let's look at the resistivity, which I think addresses your question. Here is the resistivity, and remember the phase diagram for low thorium concentrations was the one in which you get the magnetic order. So I don't know if you can see this very well, but this is a nail temperature where you get a little break in slope. This is a nail temperature, and that's the nail temperature. So you see the antiferromagnetism. But you also see the development of this more condo-like behavior. Resistivity increases at lower temperatures. But then you cross over into this regime here where you see no indication for magnetic order nor superconductivity for that reason. And here you see that the development of this very condo-looking behavior, and at low temperatures, however, you see that the resistivity doesn't appear to saturate as fast as you would expect if it had a T-squared Fermi liquid-like behavior. Okay, so here you see this crossover. Now, at low temperatures here, that's a very good question. I really don't know. We haven't really analyzed that. That's a very good question. But in some of the stoichiometric compounds, you do see resistivities that look like this. They roll over because of this coherence. And at low temperatures, you do see non-Fermi liquid characteristics in some stoichiometric compounds. Okay, so now let's go to the magnetic susceptibility. That's shown right here. So chi over chi of zero versus T over TK to the 1/2 power. And there, the reason we chose this way of representing the temperature is because at low temperatures, it's consistent with the T to the 1/2 behavior. But I'm not going to claim that describes the susceptibility over large temperature ranges. My main point here is that this scales with both X and TK. And this is the resistivity, 1 minus delta rho over delta rho of 0 versus T over TK, where the delta rho 0 is the extrapolated value. If you assume that the resistivity follows this law right here, and you extrapolate it to 0 temperature, okay, this is these ranges right here, then delta rho 0 would be the intercepts, will be the values of you'd get from this extrapolation. Now, what you find is that the data deviate away from this. And when we did this work back in 1995, we thought that we had a linear temperature dependence of the resistivity up here, or very close to it, and then it crossed over into a Fermi liquid. But of course, that contradicts everything I've shown you for the specific heat. So what we've done recently is to make new measurements, and we've gotten quite a different behavior that I want to come to now. Okay, how am I doing in time? Not very well, so I'll accelerate. Okay, so let me just tell you how we analyze the resistivity. What we do here is we treat uranium as a paramagnetic impurity ion in quotation marks because of the large concentrations that we're dealing with here. And now I've reversed the role of uranium and thorium in terms of this index X. So imagine that thorium, palladium 2, aluminum 3 is our non-magnetic matrix, and we're substituting uranium ions into it, and that these then are the so-called uranium impurity ions, taken in quotation marks. So what we've done is to express the resistivity associated with the uranium, or to calculate it from the resistivity that you measure for, say, composition X, and you subtract off the host, which is composition X equals 0. That's for pure thorium, palladium, 2, aluminum, 3. And then we express this as a contribution that we associate with potential scattering that is not a function of temperature, and another contribution that we associated with magnetic scattering, or the Kondo effect, which is a function of temperature. Okay, that's how we do this analysis. And what we find is that this contribution is proportional to X, which means that you get more potential scattering as you increase the uranium concentration, which seems physically sensible. And the Kondo contribution, we evaluate where it's equal to 0.8 times the zero temperature value of the Kondo contribution. From that, we can estimate the Kondo temperature. That turns out to be about 20 Kelvin. This is also the temperature where the resistivity starts to bend over from logarithmic behavior and starts to saturate. So that's a measure of TK. Now, for temperatures smaller than or of the order of TK, then we find that we can describe the resistivity in terms of this power law expression, where we have this as T over TK to the N power. And this prefactor we find is proportional to concentration, as it should be. And if we then take the log of 1 minus this Kondo contribution divided by its zero temperature value, extrapolated zero temperature value, it's then equal to N log T plus the log of A over TK. From the slopes, you can then deduce the exponent. And what we find is that the exponent is 1.5. The prefactor A is 0.2, which would correspond to a TK of 20 Kelvin. And again, we choose this extrapolated value to give the best approximation to a straight line at low temperatures. So anyway, those are the words. Let me just show you what we do. Here are the raw data, just to show you that here's X equals 0. And then if we increase the uranium concentration, you see the development of the resistivity minimum and the strong divergence at low temperature. Let me skip some details here. If you now take the Kondo contribution, which we extract from the data, and plot it versus the log of the temperature, what you find for these concentrations that range from 1% up to 40% uranium, you see that, you know, reasonable scaling behavior. Of course, at higher temperatures, I don't claim that that's good scaling behavior, but over these large concentration ranges, it's satisfactory in the sense that it resembles what you expect for the Kondo effect. If I take this 0.8 value right here and march down to the temperature axis, this gives me a Kondo temperature of about 20 Kelvin. And you can see that the potential scattering contribution and the Kondo contribution are roughly linearly increasing with concentration. Okay. So the phenomenology looks okay to me, but what we're really interested in is what happens at low temperatures. And so here is the low temperature data for X equal 0.2, and what you find then is that, so this is this power law dependence right here, and you can see that it fits the data up close to TK, which is around 20 Kelvin, and it fits it very well at low temperatures, although you can't see it on this kind of a plot. So you have to go to the inset where we plot 1 minus delta rho sub k over delta rho sub k evaluated at zero temperature versus T on a log-log plot. And then you see that the data can be described well by this function all the way down to 20 millikelvin. And this slope here gives you an exponent and a 1.6. And now if you look at all of the concentrations, then on the same kind of log-log plot, then you get this curve right here, these data right here. And so all of these low temperature data are consistent with this power law behavior shown down here, with the Kondo temperature of 20 Kelvin, an exponent of 1.5. You see these are all close to 1.5. And in this one case, the temperature goes down to about 20 Kelvin. So from this, I guess I conclude two things. First of all, whatever this is that seems to scale with uranium concentration and be associated with the Kondo effect, and it also scales with TK, as determined from the higher temperature data. What I don't understand is why it varies as T to the 3 halves power, because there is no single ion model that predicts that. The only model that predicts T to the 3 halves power is what you expect for an antiferromagnetic, or what you expect near an antiferromagnetic quantum critical point for a three-dimensional antiferromagnet. So like much of what we do in this business, we're always surprised, and it's really difficult to know, you know, what is the model that is really appropriate for the system. But it does seem to be single ion physics. Okay, so quickly let me now come to the other situation. This won't take me very long. So now we'll look at what happens for yttrium substitutions. There you see a rather different phase diagram. We'll be interested in what happens near this antiferromagnetic quantum critical point or spin glass quantum critical point. So here is the specific heat, C over T versus log T. And so as you increase the yttrium concentration, you're driving the Nael temperature down, or at these concentrations, this may be a spin glass freezing temperature. You're driving this to zero. And once you reach 0.7, which is the extrapolated quantum critical point, there you see the logarithmic divergence of the specific heat. Okay, so again, you see that this is a very general behavior. It occurs in virtually all of these systems, even when you have much different sources of it. Now, if you look at the resistivity, and now I'm comparing it to what happens in the previous system, uranium, thorium, platinum, 2, aluminum, 3. Remember, in that system, when you're at high thorium concentrations, you see this Kondo-like behavior where the resistivity diverges as you lower the temperature. Here, what you find is that when you're near the quantum critical point, say these concentrations at 0.8, 0.9, 0.6, you see that the resistivity, rather than continuing to diverge as you lower the temperature, it turns over and goes down. But at low temperatures, what we find is that it's linear in temperature. And so here, for that case, here's the resistivity for the sample with X equals 0.8. So you see at high temperatures, it's linear, then it rolls over. And actually, it's reminiscent of what happens when you get a coherence in heavy fermion systems. But at low temperatures, between 100 millikelvin, which is the lowest temperature of the measurement, and 7 Kelvin, it's linear in temperature, but now it's decreasing as you lower the temperature. So this appears to be due to fluctuations of an order parameter in the vicinity of an antiferromagnetic transition at 0 Kelvin, or probably this is a spin glass freezing temperature. And from the phase diagram, it looks like the Nael temperature or the freezing temperature is proportional to X minus the critical concentration to the 1 power. Okay, and the resistivity, as you can see, is proportional to temperature, and the specific heat is proportional to minus the log of the temperature. This is very similar to what happens in the cerium copper gold system, the one that you asked about earlier. And here, what this has been ascribed to in this system is 2D critical fluctuations coupled to quasiparticles with 3D dynamics. This comes from the work of von Lohneis and co-workers. And here, this requires that you have essentially a 2D antiferromagnet. So here you see that this system behaves virtually identically. This is probably a spin glass, and I wonder whether this really is the explanation. To me, this seems like a more general type of phenomenon, and perhaps some other explanation is really appropriate. The other thing that you find is if you measure the susceptibility, you get behavior where it is best described by a T to the 1/2 law. This is also true for the cerium copper gold system. And so all of these features are very similar to the cerium copper gold system. Both of them have, you know, these magnetic quantum critical points, but the question is whether you really have a two-dimensional spin fluctuations, especially if we really have a spin glass in this case, because the prediction of the specific heat for a spin glass is very different. According to work by Sachdev and Reed, it should vary as temperature to the 1/2 power. So this doesn't seem to fit in. But it does represent, you know, a very different scenario in terms of the underlying physics associated with this type of non-Fermi liquid behavior, in contrast to what you get for thorium substitutions, where you're making these substitutions into the same parent compound. One substituent just differs from the other by one electron, and you get entirely different behavior. Okay, let me just make one last remark. This is my last view graph. This is something related to all this. I just wanted to end with this. This is work done by Gil Lanzarich and co-workers, who have been trying to see what happens in the neighborhood of the quantum critical point when they squeeze away the magnetism in various ferromagnetic materials like manganese silicide and zirconium zinc 2. And here are the case of two antiferromagnetic compounds, cerium indium 3 and cerium platinum 2 silicon 2. And so what they find is that as you squeeze the nail temperature to zero in the neighborhood of the quantum critical point that would occur where these curves extrapolate to zero, they find resistivities that have power law dependences, say, that vary between 1.2 and 1.5, which is close to the predictions of T to the 3 has for an antiferromagnetic three-dimensional quantum critical point. But the really exciting thing, to me anyway, is that before they ever reach the quantum critical point, they find superconductivity in this region right here. So it appears that as if in these compounds, which are quite pure with low residual resistivities, once you drive this nail temperatures to zero, before you ever reach the quantum critical point, something else happens, and they actually observe a superconductivity. And they suggest that this is probably due to antiferromagnetic spin fluctuations. So I think that you know, this kind of research, although you know, for 10 years worth of work, we don't understand very much, but there's a lot of very exciting things that happen, a lot of surprises, and so I think it's something worthwhile to pursue, and I think it's a rather general phenomenon, and certainly I think one has to take non-Fermi liquid systems seriously, and hopefully there'll be more surprises to come. So thank you very much. Well, the only thing that's been made is the upper critical fields. And the upper critical field, the initial slope, gives you a measure of the effective mass. And these upper critical fields are large. And so the effective masses that you infer from them are heavy fermion-like effective masses. So these appear to be heavy fermion superconductors. But nobody's done specific heat. You know, we don't know what the true thermodynamic effective mass is measured directly. And we don't know if they're bulk superconductors, which is another important, you know, issue. Although it certainly, you know, looks like it must be, because this, they just peak up in the neighborhood of this quantum critical point. Not yet. We're doing some neutron scattering work now, and hopefully we'll find something out that will be helpful. Neutron scattering has been done in the cerium copper gold system, but it is rather complicated. But there is evidence for two-dimensional types of excitations, spin excitations, you know, that would be consistent with this thermodynamic properties that you measure, that in turn are what are predicted for a two-dimensional antiferromagnet. But it's controversial and by no means established, I would say. That's not cubic, yeah, right. And neither is the one I talked about. It's hexagonal, so you could imagine, you know, that you might have some transverse spin fluctuations that would have some two-dimensional character. But these certainly are not two-dimensional systems, or two-dimensional-like in the sense of the high TC materials. These are true three-dimensional materials.
transitions, when they are there, they always second order?
Well, yes, except for manganese silicide, which you mentioned the other day. That, near the quantum critical point, there is no superconductivity in that system, nor zirconium zinc 2, at least it's not been reported. But manganese silicide, you see this hysteresis, and it looks like you have some sort of critical point, and it goes from second order to first order. So. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's supposed to be a D-wave superconductor, and the line of nodes is around the equator, as I recall. I think it's D-wave.
D-wave,
yeah. Well, if you look at the night shift, yeah, it's a singlet superconductor. There's an isotropic night shift. And that system is rather nice because that's the only system where they've been able to make thin films. This is work by Hermann Hadrian that I mentioned. Thin films of high enough quality to do tunneling, junction tunneling. And they see a feature at about 1 millivolt, 1.2 millivolts, close to where you see an excitation, spin wave excitation, and far away from any phonon energies, where they infer that the spin fluctuations is the parent mechanism for that system. So it's a rather exciting possibility.
No.
Not yet. Yeah, right. Okay, thank you.